Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Just a quick note, this is January 22nd. And it was 7 years ago today that Joe Paterno passed away. Obviously, I miss him deeply. As much as I thoroughly and completely enjoy the president of Penn State football, and as much as I truly believe some of my best memories are yet to be made in the job that I have and in life, it doesn't mean I can't miss people dearly that meant a lot to me. Joe Paterno certainly was one of them. We now will get to Neil Coulong in a few moments, but first our play-by-play call of the day. I was just at Williams Arena in Minneapolis, and in the rafters there, the number 43 of Michael Thompson retired at Minnesota. His son Clay knocked down 10 straight threes last night for the Warriors.
T.J. McConnell to Joe. Joe fakes, drives it into the lane, throws up an off-balance shot. Oh, man! He threw it up backward and then tapped in his own miss. That's incredible to see a man of that size pull that off. It was like he was shooting on a Nerf hoop. Embiid now with 32.
And the Sixers were able to get the job done with Joel Embiid last night on the call on the Sixers radio network. All right, let's bring in Neil Coulong. Neil, again, ill, hanging in there, yet no guts, no glory. He's on with us today. Hello, Neil.
I made it. That's what counts.
On this show, in the end, that's all that matters.
All right. Here I am. Take it or leave it.
We'll take it. All right, Neil, let's get to the fun stuff. As I pointed out earlier, between talk shows, TV talk shows, message boards, Twitter, and so forth, I feel like it's one big let's throw ideas out there land. So obviously after the Saints-Rams game, one of the ideas floated by many, should the NFL consider using challenges on pass interference? Neil Coulong, in your ill state, what say you?
No, I'd rather fix the officials that look at pass interference and can't call it. I don't understand why. This is part of the issue. It's perpetuated so much in just even the last 15, 20 years, in the time where they wanted instant replay to begin with. It's gone from asking officials to be, in position to make the correct call, the vast majority of the time. I think everybody can accept the fact that they're going to miss calls here and there.
Yeah.
To something where replay has to determine everything. We have to stack in this game within a game where mm-hmm. we have to actively discuss the technicalities of the rules the next day instead of the game itself. I think that's the worst part of this for me. In both games, officiating became too much of the discussion following the game, to the point where you're reading all these armchair officials. They used to be armchair quarterbacks.
Yeah.
What happened to that? What happened to the, oh, man, he should have hit this guy over the middle, or that guy, they just should have run on third and three. Why didn't they do that? It's not that anymore. Now it's when they're allowed to challenge something and when they're supposed to take a look at this in review. There are way too many rules that cloud out what the game itself is. And I'm sorry, yes, replay in that situation would have fixed the egregious missed call that we saw. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody is going to say that it was a good call. But to create replay for that, which I've never seen, I've watched way more football than I even want to admit, I've never seen a blown call that bad. And
right.
That includes,
I agree,
the Joe Hayden pass interference.
Right. I've already established on the show how I feel, that I don't want an expansion of instant replay beyond what it's doing now. Look, the game is slowing down more because of it anyway, in my opinion. And the only penalty I can think of that you're allowed to review is whether you cross the line of scrimmage throwing the ball downfield. That's the only one I think you can review. I'd just rather would keep it at that. Because remember in golf, you'd have fans calling in saying, oh, that's a penalty. He moved. The ball moved. What? Okay, just sit down. Get some chips.
Yeah, you either pay people to do this or you don't. And yet, in doing that, you need to accept the fact that, one, people are going to make mistakes. And it doesn't mean that you can't do something about those mistakes after they happen. But, two, the fans cannot control the officiating on the field.
No.
Just because this was a terrible call does not mean that you have to overhaul your entire replay process, because it's not going to fix that play again. You want to know why I know that? Because there's no way that play is going to happen again. We won't see that again. To line up a bunch of situations in which the smallest, most minute things are going to have everyone freaking out the next day about why they didn't replay this or why wasn't this overturned. They're able to do that. You create such a wormhole of fan backlash determining the outcome of the game. It's not fun anymore. I understand that the call got missed. I think the Saints have adequate right to be upset about what happened. But in the larger scheme of things, things like this happen. Okay, you can't overreact about everything, and that's the biggest problem with the NFL. They are fully reactive to everything. They're not proactive about anything, and they let the fans yell and scream so much that they have to throw some kind of solution at them to make them think that they're going to be happy, without thinking of the 900 situations they're going to create the next year that's going to bring the fans back to the exact same point that they're at now. The officials suck. They're ruining the game. They're doing this. They're doing that. They're going to. You have to accept the fact that officiating is going to be a topic of conversation. You just don't have to put them in a position to fail all the time. And replay is only going to expose more warts. You can't do that.
I agree with you. I agree with you completely. And I mean, not everybody will agree with you, but I agree with you completely about that. The problem I have with officiating is this. First of all, I have great respect for what they do. I can't do it. All right? I mean, could I do it? Yeah, I could do it, but I can't do it at the level they can do it. I don't care whether it's college basketball, college football, and especially the pros. All right? I'm sitting exactly where I should be sitting. But when you miss the easy ones, or you're guessing, that's where I have an issue with it. For example, on the roughing the passer of Tom Brady, he guessed. You can't guess. He could be sitting right here. I look at him right in the face. You guessed. You can't tell.
That was my absolute first reaction after that guess. You saw his arm. You saw where it went. You didn't see it. If you didn't see it, you shouldn't be calling it. But this goes back to the overregulation that the NFL has put into it. The official is probably going to get in more trouble not flagging that. From his vantage point, he's going to get in more trouble not guessing than he will guessing.
Right.
He's not guessing, he didn't see it. So therefore, he can't throw a flag.
That's right.
But he could be wrong. If he doesn't call Tom Brady getting clocked in the head in the second half of the AFC Championship game, he's going to get in trouble for it. That's right. Why he's doing it. That's where the guess comes from. It's not the official. It's the league mandating that there are so many different things somebody can do to injure or disrupt a quarterback. They have to be on top of all of them. They're not going to. Let them watch the game from where they are. Get after him if he's in the wrong position. Otherwise, you can't say that he's going to be in the right position 100% of the time. You just can't.
The overtime rule. I don't want to change the regular season rule. 10 minutes. I got to end in a tie, end in a tie. Touchdown, fine, you win. Field goals, whatever. Do you think, though, the overtime rules should be changed in the NFL? And I'll preface it by saying this. Tom Brady is 3-0 in postseason overtime. And all three times the Patriots won the toss, and all three times the Patriots scored to win. Now, I think at least two of them are in the touchdown is over era. Obviously, the Super Bowl, and obviously this past weekend. College football, at minimum, at least allows you, each team, to have a possession. Now, albeit they jerry rig it so it's at the 25-yard line going in. I don't want to see that in the NFL. Should each team get a possession in the NFL? In postseason.
Here's the real contrast in my mind. What you have is a league that is dying to do everything they can to promote every quarterback that they can. they want final drives deciding games. They want the last team with the ball to end every single game. If they can get every game ending with a touchdown pass, they'd be perfectly fine with that.
Okay.
Their overtime
That's a very good point.
Are the opposite of that.
Right.
The issue is, in this case, just look at it from a fan perspective. Pretend that you're not me and would have done anything to see the Patriots lose on Sunday. I would have loved to see Patrick Mahomes get the ball one more time, because it was awesome to watch the two of them just going back and forth, and the plays that the receivers were making, the protection that both of those teams were getting. It was great football. I would have loved to watch Mahomes get the ball one more time, but that might have meant that the guy with the ball last lost. And the NFL doesn't want that. Whether they state it or not, they don't. That's why their overtime rules are the way that they are. They want the team. Otherwise, a field goal not ending it, you have to score a touchdown to win it after the first two possessions. What that means is, if you're not good enough to get a touchdown, here comes our game-winning drive, because that's really what we want. They want the opportunity for a touchdown to end the game. They can't do that when they're focusing so much on the quarterback all the time in every other game and in every other regulation period, playoff or otherwise. It, to me, it's just kind of confounding upon a desire to downplay defense to the point where our argument is simply that the Patriots won the coin toss. It doesn't really have anything to do with the fact that both the Patriots and Chiefs defense were completely gassed in the fourth quarter, and they just got crushed by both of those great offenses. It was fun to watch. It was dominant, superior play on both sides of the ball. I would have liked to see Mahomes get on the field one more time. I'm not saying that the Chiefs defense should have stopped him or blah, blah, blah. That's just dumb logic. I hate the thought of that. But the reality is, they want to showcase offense. They take it out of one of the offense's hands and put it into a coin. I think that in and of itself logically is stupid. I don't know what else they can do, though. There are a lot of very kind of bizarre, weird, non-football solutions. And the last thing I really want to see football do is anything that resembles the shootout that they have in soccer and hockey. I think that's just dumb. That's a side game. They should play football. I mean, if time constraints probably limit more than anything else. But if you just played a 10-minute game of football at the end, I think you'd have more pure results. I don't think they're interested in doing that, and to some degree you probably can't, but you know, maybe we can find another solution. And if it's me, I'd be up to alternatives better than what they're doing. I'm not sure there really is a good solution here, so let's just hope nobody goes to overtime from now on. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's the best.
Maybe that is the solution. No more overtime, no matter what happens. What do you think of the matchup on the Patriots and Rams? We'll get more into it next week, obviously.
I'll say this for the sake of my kids' college education. I love the fact that the Patriots started off as underdogs. I'm not sure how anybody could think that that team doesn't match up brilliantly with the Rams. I think just on paper now, if they played in a week, if give both teams 2 weeks to prepare, you generally get a tight game. And that's what they want in the Super Bowl. They get past some nagging injuries. Both teams to be at as much of full strength as they can, that's fair. But if these teams played on Sunday, I think the Patriots would walk all over them. Their offensive line is playing so well right now. They can run over anybody. Mm-hmm. And they might not have done that as well against the Chiefs. You probably kind of thought they were, but you watch Brady at the end, that's really what happened. You know, the Chiefs really wanted to stop the run, and by and large, after, you know, kind of a rough first quarter, they did. But then Brady took over because the Chiefs weren't going to be able to flip back to what they were doing before in time. And Brady has the ability to throw checkdowns better than anybody else. You get him in a pure passing situation, he's going to find somebody. And outside of Julian Edelman just forgetting where his hands were or throwing the game or whatever his problem was, he destroyed that defense in the fourth quarter. Just completely crushed them. The Rams are probably a better defensive team. Yes, I'm aware Aaron Donald is on the field, and he's kind of a tough guy to stop. But you give, you know, Scarmecchia, the offensive line coach, the only guy that rivals Mike Munchak, in my opinion.
Yes.
You give him 2 weeks to prepare, he's going to figure out a way to stop Aaron Donald. Okay, it's that simple. A lot of it is just going to be moving running backs out to the point where they're going to have Sue, you know, check him in space the same way that the Saints did to the Rams. You put all that together, I think the Patriots are just too much for him. I think Belichick is just going to overwhelm the younger coach. He's going to overwhelm the younger quarterback. And experience is just going to take him the rest of the way. I don't see this being a whole lot different than, you know, some of the other probably more competitive than I want it to be Super Bowls involving the Patriots. They're going to have the ball late. They're going to make the plays they need to make, and they're going to win in three phases of the game, particularly in the fourth quarter, to do that.
Yeah, I think the guy that to me is the key in the game for the Rams defensively is Ndamukong Suh. Because I think he's played well in the playoffs. I think he's benefited from all the attention that Aaron Donald gets. Because, I mean, Donald, I mean, he made, what, one play in the game on Sunday? What, did he make one, two plays?
I think he made the whole day.
Because they doubled him and tripled him, and, you know, he had so much attention that, you know, I mean, you know, they had to, like, show him on the sideline on camera at one point to remind everybody he was in the building.
It's like a lot of what the Rams had to do with the success they were having with Kamara was put Sue out to try to chuck him.
Sure.
Don't let him off the line. And they have to do that with bulk. You know, Sue is so big, his wingspan is so large. If he's 3 yards away from Kamara and the only thing that he's told to do is go downhill at him and hit him, don't let him get rhythm in his routes, he's going to succeed on that far more often than he's not. They had to take him out of the middle to do that, and Donald was still getting in the backfield. I mean, he didn't make plays, but that's mostly
right,
got rid of the ball because they knew he was coming.
Sure.
Donald was all over the place. He played a brilliant game, but a lot of what the Saints are able to do is what the Patriots can do. And I think because of that, they're going to have to do the same thing. Right. Move Sue out to handle the you know, passing game to the flats. I mean, look how big James White was in that game. If the Chiefs had thought to do something similar, maybe they could have stopped him earlier in the game than they did.
Exactly.
But schematically, I just, Sean McVay is, you know, I think he's a great young coach. I think he's, you know, far more, you know, praised than he is detracted for unfair reasons. But he's not going to be able to lock horns with Belichick in a Super Bowl. He's just not. I'm sorry. I've seen this play out way too many times. The Rams aren't going to be able to.
And there's the other part, too. Brady understands all of this, and so does Josh McDaniels. Brady was at 2.8 seconds per release. Got it to 2.3 on his release in the game against the Chargers, was 2.23 against the against the Chiefs. I mean, they're not giving you any time to get there.
7.5 yards down the field.
Yeah.
How do you stop that?
They're not giving you any chance to get there.
Nope, and you're not going to. And that's the strength of the Rams' defense. And from there, I don't know if you've noticed, Marcus Peters looks absolutely horrible.
Oh,
I wouldn't have any problem.
No question.
Him all game. I wouldn't be surprised. This reminds me of Fred X with the Eagles back in the day. He was trying to kind of pop off about the Patriots defense not being able to stop him to the point where Belichick just tore into him before the game, and they gunned at him all game, and they just killed him. I don't think it's going to take McDaniels a whole lot to find Marcus Peters on the field, and Tlaib will probably have to take care of Gronkowski, but Edelman's going to run wild if he actually hangs on to the ball or manages to not create controversy trying to pick up a fumble that somehow didn't touch him at all as it went past. If he plays the game that he's capable of playing, he might be the MVP. It wouldn't surprise me if he gets 10, 11 catches. Defensively, they're just not going to be able to stop him.
They might bring Deion Branch back. All right.
They're going to have to.
Get him in there for
history's purpose, you know?
You gutted it out brilliantly, I might add. I mean, in other words, I mean, let's face it. I mean, if I'm sitting here with the slow gun, I thought you threw 98 today.
I'd like to thank my sponsors, Sudafed and Airborne. If you ever had Airborne with orange juice,
no,
it's like the most underrated non-alcoholic drink you're ever going to have. It's really good. I'm serious. Try it. You pop the tab in. It works like Alka-Seltzer, but it actually tastes good. Not doesn't taste like medicine. And you drink, you feel like you can run through a wall, whether you're sick or not after it. It's highly recommended to anybody fighting the massive amount of flu we have in the state of Pennsylvania.
Well, I think we got a lot more out of this interview than I ever dreamed. All right.
Again, I'll thank the Sudafed.
Neil, my Fletch, get better, okay?
Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you.
Neil Coulong, USA Today. And also a helpful remedy. Who says this show is only about sports?
Dr. C in the house, yeah.
Back with more in a moment, brought to you by Sunbury Motors on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Sunbury Motors is bringing in the new year with the lofty goal. Sell 1,000 new Fords in 2019. You heard right, 1,000 new Fords. SMC knows they can achieve this lofty goal, and here's why. Sunbury Motors Ford has 2019 Ford Fiestas starting at $12,820. That's a new car for under $13,000. Browse Central Pennsylvania's largest selection of four-wheel drive vehicles. Pick from 68 Ford Escapes, and they're slashed to as low as $17,820. SMC has all remaining 2018 Ford Explorers reduced by $8,000, starting at $33,985. Sunbury Motors has over 100 new Ford trucks, with F-150s marked down up to $14,000, and Super Duties as much as $15,000. SMC's goal of selling 1,000 new Fords in 2019 will be your gain. Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, proudly serving all of Central Pennsylvania and the Susquehanna Valley for over a century.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Great to have you with us on the show today. The Baseball Hall of Fame announcement is about hour and a half away. Could we see three? Could we see five? That's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, I believe this is the last year Fred McGriff is eligible for induction.
On this kind of ballot. Now, remember, you have the, what is the committee called? Players of the New Generation or Players of Today or whatever it is. This is how Harold Baines got in. He would then revert to that. And I think the door would be open, by the way, for him to get in on that. 494 home runs for Fred McGriff. Never a hint of any scandal around him. Look, if you just... I think the single most... After Bonds and Clemens are over with, then the single most interesting one is going to be Alex Rodriguez. I'll give Rodriguez credit in the ability to rehabilitate his image. He has gone from despised, eyebrow raising, I don't know why he's here, to in New York, now not universally, but in New York, to becoming beloved. That run to the 2009 championship when they beat the Phillies. He had a great postseason, had a great season. Then after getting knocked out for a year, came back, hit, and the fans in New York loved him for it. So, I find that interesting. Now, is he beloved by the writers? I'll say this, the articles written about him have been far more glowing than 10 years ago. And it's going to be interesting to see what they do. Now, he won't get in the first ballot. The question will be whether he ever gets in. Oh, and he, you know, he might get in at some point. So I think that that's going to be the biggest question about him as to whether he gets in. And will he get close to the 75%? And that's going to be the question about Bonds and Clemens. Bonds and Clemens have made up about 18% in recent years. But let's be realistic about it. That's probably the easiest 18%. Of the 36. The far more difficult 18% is the ground they have to make up between that point and 75%. And that is going to be the mystery that will be solved in about an hour and a half. Mariano Rivera will be a first ballot Hall of Famer. Mariano Rivera is going to get very close to being at 100%. He's going to be very close. There's never been a unanimous one. Ken Griffey Jr. missed by 3 votes. Tom Seaver missed by 5 votes.
There was actually 11 writers that did not vote for Babe Ruth back in 1936.
He was not the, but Babe Ruth was not the leading vote getter. Ty Cobb was. Ty Cobb was the leading vote getter in the first class. Ruth was second. Interesting. Very interesting.
And 20 people did not vote for Ted Williams his first year of eligibility.
Yes. Now, I would like to point out, I would vote for Mike Mussina with complete ease. There are certain ways I judge players, and one is this. When that individual comes to the plate against my team, or that guy is pitching that night against my team, I sit back and go, big problem. Well, when Mike Mussina pitched against the Red Sox, whether he was with the Orioles or the Yankees, I always thought every night is going to be a fight. That guy's good. That guy is good. And that's part of the criteria I use as to how I look at somebody, that you just know in watching them that they're outstanding. It's not just against your team. It's because of everything they've done against everybody else. Mike Mussina was like that.
This is the sixth year that Moose is on the ballot. First year, he received just 20.3% of the vote. We'll do some comparisons, wins, losses, between Mussina and Roy Halladay. Roy Halladay, 203-105 with a 3.38 ERA. And Mussina was 270-153 with a 3.68 ERA.
Roy Halladay was a nine-inning pitcher. Wanted the ball, didn't want to come out of the game. As his career advanced, he got better and better and better. You know, then finally, obviously, at the end, the injuries finally got to him. Mike Mussina was consistent from day one. Tell me where the dip in Mike Mussina's career was. Where was it? He was really good. Curt Schilling should be in. You know, there. You know, and if anybody wants to sit there and they want to hold, well, I don't like what he tweets. I don't care what he tweets. I don't care what anybody tweets.
Schilling's career record, 216-146. 3.46 ERA, so his ERA is in between Halliday's and Messina's.
Yes, but here's the big one. 11-2. 11-2 in postseason games. That tells me a lot. Money's on the table. Biggest moment. Facing one of the top two teams in baseball. Or the top four teams in baseball. How do you do?
Well, bloody Sox story, I mean, that'll live in baseball with playoff infamy.
Yeah, but what he did with the Phillies in 93. What he did with the Diamondbacks in 2001 in conjunction with Randy Johnson. Then what he did with the Red Sox. But in 93, the Phillies had a team. You know, you're taking on the defending champion Toronto Blue Jays. He got that ball. He was terrific that postseason with the Phillies in 93. Then he goes to the Diamondbacks. Boom, they win the championship. They beat the Yankees. The Yankees were the most dominant team in the late 90s, early 2000s. And he and Randy Johnson combined to beat that team. Combined to do it. All right, then he went to the Red Sox, who had won in 86 years, and in combination with everybody else, Ortiz, Ramirez, Pedro Martinez, Derek Lowe, so forth, they won. And he was a big reason why. Didn't pitch well against the Yankees the first time. Then, of course, you mentioned the bloody sock game in Game 6. Then he comes out. I was at Game 2 of the World Series that year when he dominated the Cardinals for six innings with the other bloody sock. You know, then in 2000, people forget, what was his last start of his career? What was the last appearance of Curt Schilling's career? Game 2 start, World Series, Colorado Rockies. Who was the winning pitcher in a shutdown performance? Curt Schilling. That's the last start of his career. 11-2. There's certain pitchers I want the ball in the biggest games. Jack Morris got in and should have been in voted, by the way. He got in on this other committee. Okay? Jack Morris would absolutely be a guy like that. Curt Schilling would be one. Roy Halladay would one. Mike Mussina would be one. I had Game 7, and I'm looking around, and they say, look, your choice is this other guy and Mike Mussina. I picked Mike Mussina. To me, when you make that statement about somebody, Right? If I had a choice of Game 7, all the marbles on the table, and my choice is Mike Mussina or Clayton Kershaw, I pick Mussina. Even though Kershaw, his record in the regular season is off the charts. Off the charts. Okay? And I know he was banged up, and I know it's unfair to say he went 0-2 against the Red Sox in the World Series. All right. But he's had chances. Guys like Morris, Schilling, Mussina. To me, that's the gauge in the end. You know, well, all these guys are 200 game winners. They're all 200 game winners. All of really great ERAs. All right, I need a swing factor. Right? Well, guess what? That's Curt Schilling out there against the Toronto Blue Jays, against the Yankees, twice, against the St. Louis Cardinals. That's Jack Morris out there against the Atlanta Braves with the Twins. Against the Padres in the 84 World Series. Mike Mussina, all those great performances with the Yankees. To me, that becomes a determining factor. What kind of pitcher are you when you're facing great lineups with everything on the line? Same thing with hitters. Everything's on the line. Do you hit? And to me, with the modern player, you have so many more playoff games now. For example, look at, you mentioned Ted Williams. Ted Williams played only 7 postseason games his entire career. His entire career, he played 7. That was 1 World Series against the Cardinals, and he hit 200. You know how many postseason home runs Willie Mays hit? Take a guess. How many postseason home runs did Willie Mays hit?
Why am I thinking this is a trick question? I'll say 2.
0. He never hit a postseason home run with the New York Giants, the San Francisco Giants, and the New York Mets. Okay? So not everybody in the postseason has that moment. But when but Willie Mays didn't need postseason. Well, he made the catch, obviously, against Joe Adcock and the Indians. But Willie Mays didn't need postseason success because there wasn't as much of it. Ted Williams, there wasn't as much of it. The Yankees were in every year, for goodness sakes. With playoff expansion, though, brings with it a different level to look at as opposed to the greats from years gone by. Ty Cobb didn't have anywhere near the World Series experience that Babe Ruth had because the Yankees were so dominant. And, of course, Cobb played for both the Tigers in the last 2 years with the Philadelphia A's, competing against the Yankees. Well, you're not going to get in the World Series that often. You're not going to get the postseason play. But now you have many more opportunities to get the postseason play. And because of what's happened with postseason expansion in the last, especially the last 20 years, but over the last 40 years, because this is 40 years now of San Diego, Montreal, Kansas City, and the Seattle Pilots coming in. The Pilots are now the Brewers. Right? Coming in and expanding, and the extra round of the playoffs began. We just went through the 40th year of expanded playoffs. Now I think that does come into play more as to what kind of postseason player were you? Because you have so many more opportunities at postseason play to show what you can and cannot do in the clutch. Before that, like Ted Williams had 1 World Series. Okay, how many World Series was Ty Cobb in? How many World Series was Walter Johnson in, as opposed to Lou Gehrig, Joe DiMaggio, Babe Ruth? The Yankees were in so often, there are so many people that didn't get any postseason experience to speak of in their lifetime. I mean, Ernie Banks never played a postseason game in his life. Ernie Banks played no postseason games in his lifetime. None. So you're not going to have any. Willie McCovey played in what? Postseason twice? 62 and what, 71 maybe? That was it. So it's a little bit different judging postseason success now to postseason of years gone by for guys. Now I think postseason, because there are so many postseason games, so many times you've got to go through great lineups. That I think that it you know, it becomes to me a determining factor that you have to look at. And if I'm looking at Jack Morris, I'm looking at Curt Schilling, I'm looking at Mike Mussina and people like that, I'm saying to myself, do I want them to have the ball in the biggest game of the season? And the answer is yes. And if I'm saying the answer is yes to that, then that's telling me that they should be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, that's just me. You might have a different opinion. I've heard, well, it's not the Hall of Very Good. Like, yeah. Okay, I got you. I understand that. But Mike Mussina was far beyond very good. Mike Mussina should be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. In fact, he should have been in the Hall of Fame 3-4 years ago. I am a believer in that. I know if you're in the Hall of Fame, you're a Hall of Famer. But I do believe that there is a spot, for example, for the Mariano Riveras of the world, where I look at a Mariano Rivera and I say he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. I think that designation is important. Then the second year I change everything. You're either in, you're in. But to me there's a special designation for somebody to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. That to me, of the Hall of Famers, you're now at the different level. I don't know how you feel about that, Sean.
I would think if both Roy, well, obviously, you know, Moe's going to be in tonight at Slam Dunk, but I would think if it's going to be both.
Halliday's going to make it.
Yeah, Moe and Halliday, I would think, when was the last time three pitchers got in the same year? I would think that, would that create a roadblock from Mike getting in tonight?
What was the year? I'm trying to think with Smoltz or Glavin, the year they get in. I thought there were a lot of pitchers in that year. I think that, to me, that doesn't matter. Remember, it was 1 year ago we had Jerry Kramer on the show. We had Jerry Kramer on the show the day before he was voted into the Hall of Fame for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And the old argument has been, and I want to touch on another one, Andy Russell, in a moment. Well, there's too many Packers in. The Hall of Fame is not a team award. The Hall of Fame is an individual award. Are you one of the best in the lifetime of the league at that position? Andy Russell, and the argument against Andy Russell is going to be, well, there's so many Steelers in. Who cares? I don't care. Andy Russell should be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And Jack and I have talked about this. Jack has been a quiet advocate behind the scenes for this. Andy Russell should be in the Hall of Fame. So now let's bring it back to what you're talking about. There's so, you know, it's too many pitchers. No, it's an individual thing. If you're a great pitcher, you should be in. If they elect five pitchers tonight, that's because all five deserve to be in.
2015, three pitchers went in: Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez, and John Smoltz.
All right, I got the Smoltz part right. All right. Okay, we'll wrap it up in a moment here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. All right, you have some people that have sued the NFL, by the way, because of mental anguish. I mean, I understand completely getting upset about it.
They're trying to get a judge to make the vote to get both teams back in the dome to replay the back end of the game.
The answer's wrong. Answer's no. Last I checked, you had the ball to start overtime. So, which means if you scored a touchdown, you would have ended it there.
The NFL is also investigating a laser pointer that was allegedly used on Tom Brady right before the one of his interceptions that he threw.
You know, to be honest with you, though, it's not only that, but all the whistles that were in the stands, and you could hear them on TV. To be honest with you, that's something I think they've got to take a look at. If the officials are using whistles, then I don't think the people in the stands should be allowed to have them too, because I could hear them in the background. I kept a couple times I thought, are they going to be called for procedure? What's going on? I'm talking about on the field, and it's like, oh, wait, that was in the stands. And I think that that's something that you need to look into. It's like, hey, guys, no whistles. You can't have it. Laser pointers? Yeah. That's an issue. That is an issue. No getting around it. It's, Yeah, there's one thing to have home field advantage. There's another thing to have some home field class, too.
Well, you know, this is the first time that they hosted a conference championship game. Not all that much experience out there. Despite one of the loudest stadiums in the league.
That's true.
I saw various beat reporters on Twitter were posting that fans were throwing beer cans out onto the field multiple times during the game. I'd say act like you've been there, but...
Yeah.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury. You can hear us anywhere in the world with the Sunbury Broadcasting Corporation app.